Welcome to Bubbles and Benevolence, the podcast where we pop the bubbles to success and dive deep into the benevolent hearts of those who have achieved it. In this podcast, we'll sit down with successful business leaders, philanthropists, nonprofit workers, and more to discuss their journeys, the lessons they've learned along the way, and how they're using their success to make a positive impact on the world. So grab a glass of bubbles and join us as we explore the intersection of business and benevolence and discover what it truly means to be successful.
Today's guest is Fleur Sharp. Fleur is bubbly, benevolent, and coincidentally, one of my best friends. Fleur started her career in commercial radio and then moved into event management, but it was little wonder that her passion for cooking and good food led Fleur into a career first with Thermomix Australia, and then creating her own company offering cooking demonstrations called Cook, Live, Love. Fleur has followed her lifelong passion for cooking, for celebrating food with family and friends, and it is little wonder that our paths were destined to cross. She has been part of the Hamworth story since the beginning, and it's my absolute delight to bring her story to you today.
Okay, so welcome, Fleur, to the Bubbles and Benevolence podcast. I think we should add Bubbles, Benevolence and Besties,
yes,
to the title.
Triple B.
This wonderful broadcast. And I'm so excited because not only is Fleur someone I've met along the road through the Hanworth journey, but she's probably snuck in because I actually met her a little bit before. So
yes.
How did we connect, Fleur?
Well, I remember meeting you for the first time probably back in 07, 08, when we worked on a sort of charity women's event called the Australian Women of the Year. And we kind of connected over benevolence, but also bubbles, because we were both lovers of champagne. And so very much our friendship was forged over benevolence and bubbles. So that's a really nice connection. And I'm really thrilled to be here for your second ever podcast. So
I know, we're very excited. It was such a great response to the first. So we hope
I loved
that
it.
We definitely made sure we had a great visitor for the second one. Mm. So what bubbles have you brought in for us to share today?
Well, and there's quite a story behind this, but when we first met, for some reason we both liked Veuve Clicquot. I think because Madame Veuve Clicquot had such a rich story. She was a strong woman. We really loved her story about how she managed to keep her house afloat through the German occupation of France, and it's still one of the greatest houses left, and we have a connection which we'll explain more about in this podcast. But I chose Veuve Clicquot because it's kind of us. Every time I look at a Veuve Clicquot bottle, I think of you.
And I think it would be lovely to share the story, because I did actually mention in my last episode that Veuve Clicquot was the champagne of Hanworth. And we did receive a couple of questions as to, why?
Yeah, well, good question. Because we'd kind of enjoyed Veuve Clicquot over time. And I remember back in, a number of years ago now, like maybe 10 or more years ago, 11 years ago, I knew you were spending a lot of time with your mum while she was sick. And I hadn't seen you for a long time because you were spending a lot of time down the Gold Coast. And I remember very vividly one day walking in my local shopping centre, and it was just like one of those inspiration moments where undeniable, it was like a voice said to me, go to the nearest bottle shop, buy a bottle of Veuve Clicquot, drive to the Gold Coast and go and visit Marisa while she's in the hospital with your mum, just to have a visit. Marisa needs to, you know, have see you. So I did that. I just followed that intuition, and we arrived there, and I was like, oh God, sorry, I'm that weird friend that turns up at a hospital with a bottle
with
of champagne. I was like, oh, is this weird? But anyway, so, and I remember your brother David was there, and I visited with you and while Romana was in hospital, and we were enjoying a glass of champagne. And I think it was the first time David had ever had.
Well, right? I recall saying to him and you, I don't think that we can open a bottle of champagne in the hospital. Of course, you, Fleur, being Fleur, says, well, why not?
Well, why not?
And I said, well, there's no glasses, for one.
That's right, plastic cups.
I think you ran up to the kind of bathroom where they have those little paper cups and came back with those. And my brother declared, well, actually, I think she can open the bottle because I've never tasted champagne.
Here you go. So we did, and we were having a lovely chat, and this is quite a moment. While we were chatting, it was a very peaceful moment. Your mum, dear Romana, passed away. She wasn't expected to pass at that time, but she did. And I reflect back on that moment as a moment where I felt really true inspiration from, you know, the universe or whatever you call it, to go and do that night. But I kind of feel like Ramana knew that you were in a good place, and she kind of felt like it was okay to go. And ever since that time, our friendship has been strong, and the connection with Verve Clicquot in that moment is why Verve Clicquot has become the champagne of Hanworth House, which you bought in remembrance of your mother. So, yeah.
So that's how Verve Clicquot became the champagne of the house. And also, I felt incredibly blessed that you left two children at home in Brisbane, hopefully not by themselves. And I remember when you said you were coming to the Gold Coast, I said, please don't come, I'm fine, by which time you were already almost at Burleigh or somewhere. So yep. You were so close. And I always remember, well, that's what best friends do, isn't yep. it? I mean, that's a definition of a bestie, someone who drops everything because they feel like they have to be with somebody that they feel strongly about. So we are bonded for life over both being besties and over Verve Clicquot as the champagne of the house. And in fact, there's a corner at Hanworth
House. Well, next to my corner, yeah, which will tell you more about my connection to Hanworth House in a little bit. But yes, there is a very special corner at Hanworth House, right on the corner of the right side of the veranda, where one side is Verve Clicquot and then there's me. So yeah, I'm very feel very honoured to have such a spot in the historic house of Hanworth House.
And so I'm fortunate, or unfortunately, you are what I always call my first unofficial resident. And I call you the unofficial resident because there were no rules at Hanworth at that time, but you broke every rule. Should we have had rules at the time?
And so, I always say, in my defence, these rules don't exist anymore, probably because they were futile. But, yeah, no, do you want to talk about that?
Like, well, I think that would be lovely. Yeah. I mean, we did know each other, but you actually did become the first resident of Hanworth. Mm.
Well, I did, but years before that, I remember going to Hanworth House when you said to me, oh, I'm thinking of buying this old house. And I was like, what, where? And I'd never seen it, even though travelling, a lot of people say this, don't they? They travel down Lytton Road and they've never seen it because it was kind of hidden behind a lot of trees. And I remember going there with you once and walking through this old house that was owned by the Anglican Church. And I remember going up into what is now your office, and there was a lovely lady living there. She was an opera singer, I think, and she rented it for like a nominal amount. But it was this really bohemian kind of place. It had something. It had a spirit about it that I knew you were going to take and make into something amazing, which you've done, like, incredibly. So I remember going there a lot. But then in 2014, my marriage broke down, and while it had been something that had probably been coming for a very long time, I didn't really have much of a plan around getting out of that situation, but you very kindly allowed me to come and live at Hanworth because at that point it was being rebuilt for the second time. And you talked a lot about the fire in the first episode. We kind of don't need to go over that, but I remember being going through that with you. And but it was at the point where a couple of rooms, and I was in the Mary room for 3 months, and it really became a place where, well, as I say on my column at Hanworth House, it gave my heart a home when I needed it most. It was exactly what you wanted it to be for women. It was a safe and a calming, embracing place. And I know I'm not the first woman to come to Hanworth House and feel that, there has been many women since in the same situation as me that did that. So so yes, Hanworth is very much part of my heart.
And your DNA. So yes. You left your imprint on Hanworth in many respects, and I'm so grateful. I remember when we were renovating you, we used to come over on Friday afternoons and share a champagne. Always
Fridays at four.
That's right. Fridays at four was when we downed tools and we all had a get together. And most people thought I was crazy embarking on this project, but we always shared a glass of beer if I was with the builders, or champagne was with my girlfriends.
We used to bring the champagne out, and we used to gather all the old lady chairs, you know, the vinyl chairs for when it was an old people's home, and we'd bring them around in a circle. It was so fun. And then the wheelchairs. Remember the wheelchairs?
Yeah, we used to worry about actually who'd sat on those chairs and how many incidences there might have been whilst they were sitting there. So I was blessed in many respects, first having met you over a benevolence kind of reason, but we'll get to talk about that a bit later on, and continued that journey by having you live in Hanworth and then imprint a small piece of your heart on it. But Fleur, you're born in Toowoomba. just to go back for a little bit. And I mean, it would be really nice to kind of talk about how we even came to meet. I mean, you're a Toowoomba girl. So how did we even manage to meet in the city of Brisbane? So tell me a bit about growing up in Toowoomba.
Yeah, grew up in Toowoomba. I didn't come to Brisbane until I was 21 and grew up in a very sort of, you know, middle class kind of, you know, family. And like with your family, we would give, like when, you know, Salvo's knocked on the door or whatever, we would never have called it philanthropy or benevolence. There was no such words. It was just doing what you could with what you had. And I certainly felt like my parents demonstrated that to me growing up. But, yes, so I grew up in Toowoomba, came to Brisbane when I was 21. Again, not with much of a plan. I'm a bit of a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants kind of gal. And then I had a career in commercial radio, married and had children. I had a great time in commercial radio. Gosh, it was so much fun. And from there, I kind of, when I had the kids, my boss at 4KQ at the time said, look, we really need someone to run the Queensland Radio Awards. Would you be interested now you're not kind of working full time with the kids? And I was like, hell yes, that sounds like the best fun. So for a number of years, I ran the Goldies, which was a historical radio awards here in Queensland. And that was wonderful. And the experience that event management gave me sort of led me to do other events. Like I worked on Mercedes-Benz Fashion Festival, which was a wonderful experience. And I did Clean Up Australia Day for Ian Kiernan. But as the children were young, event management is a really intense kind of job, and it just didn't fit with having very small children, being away from home for, you know, in an event lead up. So I at that stage had been I'd recently bought a Thermomix. A girlfriend of mine had bought a Thermomix, and she was very good at convincing me that I should be selling these machines. And that started a 10-year career with Thermomix, but more importantly, it was such a great fit for me because of my connection with food. And my mother, both my grandmothers and my paternal great-grandmother was an excellent cook, and my great-grandmother Nan was an exceptional cook, and I'd kind of been the one in the family to carry that through. So working in food through Thermomix was a wonderful experience, and I became the commercial specialist, and I helped them develop their cooking classes. And had a wonderful time there. And then that led to me doing my own cooking classes outside of the Thermomix brand. So, yeah, and I still do those today, online courses and cooking classes.
So what do you think kind of fostered that initial interest in food? You say your grandmother's. Mm. But, I mean, what was it that, I mean, was this an era of domestic science at school and that kind of thing?
Mrs. Peters is listening to this. She'll be laughing out loud because I was like the worst home ec person ever. That chocolate blancmange was a D minus that I made. No, it was really, I really loved the idea that, you know, cooking a meal in your kitchen, something you make with love that tastes delicious, and sharing it with the family, and that idea of the family coming together at the end of the day, sharing your stories and sharing food with the people you loved. There was something about that that resonated with me, and I think that's just part of my soul, who I am. Like anyone else could have had the same upbringing and not be as connected with food. But I hear the stories of my great-grandmother Nan. She made everything from scratch. She even made her own yeast with things on the back step in heat. I think she was also probably making vodka. you know, she made absolutely everything the family ate from scratch, and that's what I wanted to do, particularly when I first started to have children. I wanted to be able to make every meal that they had. And in the modern era, that was actually quite difficult to do, particularly if I worked. Like my great-grandmother didn't work, my grandmother didn't work. They were very good housekeepers, but that wasn't my story. And I think that's what I liked about the Thermomix, because it allowed me to make everything from scratch, but in a modern context. So I really loved, you know, just that, I think the word is commensality, coming together and sharing a meal. That's what I'm all about.
And you were really a kind of a bit of a pioneer in Thermomix in Brisbane. I mean, everyone was really asking why is this thing so great?
Yeah.
And you were really there at the ground level, I think, when it was being really introduced into the Australian context.
It had been in Australia for a number of years before I came along, but it was mostly in Western Australia. But when I started doing it in 2011, no one had really heard about it. And now it's everywhere. There's magazine ads in the Women's Weekly, there's three or four cookbooks at Kmart. Like, it's just, it's really taken hold because of it. It's just a really good machine, and it really helps people cook. Not just home cooks, not just day-to-day cooks, but my area of interest with Thermomix was how chefs used it, because chefs love it as well. So that's what kind of led me to working with chefs and loving the restaurant side of it as well.
And so that became another new road that you travelled. I mean, introducing it to the chefs, but you did really begin quite a wonderful relationship with chefs in Brisbane.
Yeah.
So have you got a favourite story about those connections with chefs, or an
so
interesting
many.
Foodie story that you could share with us and not embarrass anybody, of course?
Yeah, so I'm rifling through my mind now going, which one can I say in a public forum? Actually, I think one of the funniest ones was one of my dearest friends is Philip Johnson from Echo, and many of your listeners will probably be familiar with Echo. He's a legend in the food scene.
And his book is on the Hanworth kitchen shelves.
Is it? Oh,
yes,
very
definitely.
Good. Very good. But I became, through Thermomix and our connection, where I became good friends with Phil and his wonderful partner Mary, and I remember once I invited him over for lunch, and I was also really good friends with Josh Lopez, who you'll remember from, he was a Goma and he had the wolf, and his lovely wife Crystal. And stupid me decided, like, who would invite two of the top chefs in Brisbane over for lunch but me? But I was like, you know what, I'm not going to try and impress them. It would be so tempting to cook something really impressive dinner to show up, but I was like, no, I'll just do something really simple. So I did great oysters, and I did this like salmon tarator. Was a really simple dish, but delicious, and a pavlova. And then Philip Johnson walks in to our dinner party, and he bought lots of champagne. And I said, oh, welcome. And he's like, what are we eating? And I said, look, oysters and seafood. Look at this massive salmon that I've made. I'm doing salmon tarator. And he goes, you do remember I'm allergic to seafood, right?
So one of the best chefs in Brisbane, totally allergic to seafood.
Yeah, well, he's actually not. He was back in the day. He's actually not now, but he, because of the previous experience with seafood, he's a no to it. But I was just, you should have seen the look on my face. I was just like, what do I do now? But yeah, so the moral of that story is always ask your guests if they've got any allergies.
That's exactly right. And it's really interesting. I think it's through you that we ended up Hanworth forging a connection with many chefs in Brisbane.
Yeah.
But most specifically, Josh had an amazing pop-up restaurant at Hanworth. And when his air conditioning was broken at the Wolf, that was one of the most memorable nights I can think of. All these beautiful couples, fours, six, eight people on the front lawn.
Best
and
night.
Absolutely.
It was New Year's, wasn't it? It was a New Year's Eve.
Might have been New Year's.
Sure,
I can't quite remember, but it was a beautiful night. And we felt very privileged to have such a chef of his standing. And also Philip Johnson is now one of our regular caterers. Mm. We love having Phil and Mary over, and they often cater for corporate and weddings. And so it's actually through you, I think, that Hanworth has weaved. It always weaves its magic through many avenues. But we've come to have wonderful relationships with them and Alistair McLeod. And it's great to support the chefs in Brisbane, which is probably a lovely segue into returning a little bit to the benevolence aspect of the podcast, because you did something really, really interesting during COVID. And I think it's certainly worth sharing about how you and your passion ended up doing something great for the community.
Yeah, it was very much a moment in time thing. And it was that you'll all remember when it was that first few days of lockdown, when everyone was just like, what does this mean? What is the impact? Everyone was sort of shell-shocked, and that we were stuck at home. We couldn't go anywhere. And I had a message from an old friend of mine from Toowoomba, and he said he'd just heard about this charity thing that was happening in LA, and it was getting great great momentum, and it was called Feed the Frontline, and in Los Angeles. And basically what it was is the public were giving to a GoFundMe, then the funds were then being distributed to a group of restaurants, and in return they were giving, for the same value, gift vouchers, which were going to frontline workers. And he told me about this, and they'd raised an enormous amount of money, like it really went wild. And I went, I can do this here. And it was just one of those things, and it, in so many ways it saved me as much as it helped other people. So within 24 hours, we started Feed the Frontline Brisbane, And I remember calling in lots of favours. Kylie from the Courier Mail, Kath Rose for the PR, Dyer Riley helped me as well. And then there was a number of chefs like Phil and Josh and Claire from Spaghetti House and Javier from Moda. And I pulled everyone together. I said, we're going to do this. We're going to start a GoFundMe. And we got some publicity, thanks to Kylie at the Courier Mail. And people started donating. And they $10, $20, $50, $2,000, and we then took this money and we distributed it amongst the small group of restaurants that we knew were going to stay the distance through. That we knew that the public's donations were going to be safe in the hands of these restaurants. So we divided up the money, and then in return they gave us for the same amount gift vouchers. So the restaurants got a very a much needed injection of funds, because at that time JobKeeper hadn't kicked in. It took some time for the kind of government funding to kick in. They got an injection of funds, and then we were able to then go and give, you know, thousands of dollars worth of gift vouchers for a lovely meal to like RBWH. And I remember Simone Garski really helped me out with the RBWH Foundation, and same with the Mater. And there was lots of injection and testing clinics at that time we gave vouchers to. And the public really got on board with it, because the sentiment was that we really appreciated and were thankful for the people that were on the front line, that were turning up to work, facing this pandemic face on, not knowing whether they're going to be bringing it back to their own families. And the sentiment was that we wanted to be able to give them the gift of a lovely meal when they were off duty. So I think we raised almost $30,000 in a couple of weeks. It gave those restaurants an injection of funds to keep them going before the government funding kicked in. And then it was also a lovely gift to the frontline, not just doctors and nurses, but also, you know, all the other hospital workers that were out there, the testers. And I don't know, it was a whirlwind of a thing, but it also... And this is what I think about any kind of benevolence. There's always a two-sided benefit to it, and that it really gave me a purpose and a feeling of making a contribution at a time when I felt lost, having lost all of my cooking classes and contracts for workshops and stuff like that. So, yeah, I'm very proud of that little thing that I did then.
So I think it's a great example of crisis being the precursor of a lot of innovation. And you cottoned onto an idea, but lots of people have a good idea, right? Mm. And so I'm guessing there's a lot of people who are asking, how do you even start to do something like that? I mean, it's not like you had a massive cash fund behind you to start this off. I mean, what are some of the risks? Or, and I guess there's probably some learnings from you having done it as well.
Yep.
But I think if you just think about Feed the Frontline as a great innovation, as you said, you didn't think too much about it. If you look back on it, what did you learn?
Well, I learned pretty quickly that I needed someone trusted to be able to look after the money side of it, and that's where Dyer Riley and her husband Stephen came in as a solicitor. So he allowed us to use his trust account, and then he kind of audited everything so I could put up a page on GoFundMe and people could give with trust, like knowing that it was going to be managed properly. That was probably the biggest thing that I'm thankful someone said to me right at the front, you need to do this. You can't just set up a GoFundMe and have these funds go into your own personal bank account. It just doesn't work like that. So there's that. But I also do think, don't overthink it as well. I remember thinking, okay, I've got this idea. What do I do? And the first thing was to set up a GoFundMe page and then to reach out to the people around me that I knew could help me do it, because no one person can do something like that single-handedly. So I think the second lesson is leaning on the people around you and inspiring them to come on board with you. So if you've got a vision for an event or for a charitable organisation, then you've really got to be able to be crystal clear on what that is and be able to communicate that to the people that you want to inspire to come on board with you.
So it was a fantastic initiative. So, you know, congratulations again. We everyone seemed to know about it really quickly.
Yeah,
But you also give people an opportunity who frequent restaurants and like to actually back the restaurant industry. It gave them an opportunity to keep doing that, exactly. when they couldn't go and dine at those tables.
Yes.
So I think that was a wonderful initiative, and I guess your benevolent heart continues in many respects, but that was really something you did on your own with very little or no initial thought and just got it done and yep. made a difference. So that's what my best friend is capable of, and it's what a lot of listeners would be capable of as well if the passion is enough to make it purposeful and yeah. you can actually go forward.
Well, inspired by you, I see you every day doing things like that and starting another event or another initiative. And so you, I know, don't underestimate how much you inspire not just me but other people around you.
Thank you. But then there's failures in there as well, and you learn from those mistakes as well. I think Feed the Frontline was yet another example of you collaborating around food. Mm. And I think there's a lot of people, particularly our children and people at school now, that there's a very different relationship with food, typically. You know, what advice would you give to people who are trying to build connectivity in their perhaps young families around food when it's so easy to get something pre-made these days? I mean, and it can be tough to kind of have the tools. Where do you start when you perhaps haven't grown up in a family that cooks? I mean, I was fortunate. I think I've talked about it. My mother was a good cook. But what about people who don't see examples of families getting back to their roots and cooking? What are some simple steps that someone saying, I really want to get into this food industry? This slow food movement is really big these days. How do you start, Fleur?
Well, I think it does start in the home, and it's got to be something that you want to involve your whole family in. And I'm going to say that I was guilty of this, of not bringing the kids in because I was scared of the mess. I know every mum out there will be going, hell no, I don't want the kids in the kitchen. I have to clean it up. And that was a mistake I made. But I think there's two things. If you've got a young family, I think it's kind of a little bit easy because I think kids naturally want to see what you're doing and get involved in cooking. And that would be my first thing, would say, let them get involved, clean up the mess, because them having a connection to food is going to be something that stays with them their whole life. So allow them to pull a chair up to the bench and get their hands into it. But also allow them to choose the menu. Like, and this works particularly well if your children are a little older, is, you know, hand them a cookbook. We've shared a cookbook just over this weekend, amazing, haven't we? Give them a cookbook and say, pick a recipe, and then we'll go and get the ingredients and let's make it together. And so, you know, when there's involvement in that way, particularly with younger children, because I've got a theory that young kids, it's, even if they're fussy eaters, they will literally eat anything they've had a hand in making.
Wow.
Yeah. But with older kids, if they're like, you know what, I think that sounds really, let's like break that down and then make it kind of a family thing as well, to make it together and then to serve it together. I think that's wonderful. I also like entertaining that way. Sometimes when I have friends over, I like to do like pizza nights are really good. I do like, okay, so here's the dough, here's all the ingredients, knock yourself out. And there's so much fun in putting a meal together and then sitting down and eating it together. So I would say, yeah, definitely allowing someone else to plan, but then also as time goes on, particularly with teenage children, make it like, okay, every Wednesday night, you cook. It's your night to cook, and be there to support them in doing that. And I think that's how they can start to make mistakes in cooking. Holy heck, how many things have I stuffed up in my time? And I'll give it to my mother. She let me make those mistakes. So, yeah.
And I've actually been privileged to be a guest at quite a few things that you've made. Double baked cheese souffles as a group. Oh my goodness, what an amazing recipe that is.
Yeah.
I have to put that little recipe on the link to this podcast.
That's actually a Terry Galichet when he had Montrachet. Oh. That's his recipe. Yeah, let's share that.
It is great because you can make it in advance as well and serve it when the guests come. I like anything that you can do that with. So yes, let's share that recipe
because
that is one of my favourite recipes that I have you to thank for that.
Yeah, it's really good.
And when we're lucky that we have so many great ingredients and great stores that we can get them from, with Harris Farm and James Street these days, and so many sophisticated stores that have the kind of back to farm basics.
Yeah, exactly.
But one of the things that people often ask is, what is this slow food movement?
Well, it's been started in Italy, but there's also a big American movement as well. And it's really about going back to like seasonal, regional, and just eating what is growing, eating what's growing in your area in the season where it's meant to be. Nobody wants to eat a mango in July. Well, and it won't taste the same. It's got to be food. It's food in context, and it's food that comes to the plate in its own time, and it's appreciated in its own time. So to grow food well, it can't be done fast. I know that from the commercial farming perspective, they all wanted to be grow quicker and faster and cheaper, and that's the exact opposite of what slow food is. So for me, it could be even growing some things in your backyard or even on your balcony. I live in a fifth floor apartment, but I've still got quite a big herb garden. I think I've got some cherry tomatoes coming up now. So there's ways of even bringing in homegrown food, even into the smallest of apartments. So yeah, to take it slow, go and find out. Like anything that's kind of out the front, if you go to like a Harris Farm or a fruit and veg, or anything that's out the front and it looks delicious and it's not expensive, that's at the peak of its season. Buy that, find some great recipes for that, and you'll not only be eating food that's at its peak of deliciousness and its nutrients, but you'll also be saving a lot of money, because that's how our ancestors ate. They didn't eat things out of season because they couldn't.
It's a bit of a situation in which you get what you get.
Mm.
You have what you have,
yeah.
And you don't go seeking things that perhaps are not readily available.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's probably how I now cook. Instead of going to a recipe and writing a list of things that you need, then going and buying it, you do it the reverse. You go to the grocery store, you see I don't love the big grocery stores. I think like the independent butchers and independent fruit and veg shops, they're the ones that have the best stuff. Go there and see what inspires you, what looks good, and then take it home and find something to make with that.
And it's easy to do that on the internet.
Absolutely.
Now. Recipes for turnips, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then once you've done that a couple of times, you don't need to look at that recipe. You go, oh, turnips are in season again. I'll go and make that recipe I made last time because it was so delicious. So, yeah.
We're coming back now to how we've bonded over benevolence.
Mm.
And you said that you grew up in a similar family to mine, mm-hmm. Not necessarily people we would call philanthropic. What drew you to helping others?
Well, I think it's just a basic human need. I really, when you think about the six human needs that we all need food, we all need shelter, we all need safety and security, but we also need to have a sense of belonging and a sense of contribution. And I think that when you are benevolent or you're helping others, it is, like I said before, it's a two-way street. You get something out of it yourself. You get that feeling that you have contributed and made someone else's life better. And particularly with the way you approach philanthropy, it's never done as just a single donation. Very often we come together in a group to create something, some kind of charity event. And I think there's a lot to be said about that as well. When a group of benevolent people come together, we put on a great event, or you put on a great event, and we all contribute to something, there's a great sense of belonging and contribution in that. And kind of self-esteem. You want to feel good about yourself that you've helped someone out. I don't know. There's something just deep in my soul whenever I feel like I've given somebody a good meal, or I've contributed to somebody that can benefit from my help. I feel good about that. I feel like that's me doing what I was put on this planet to do.
And let's face it, I mean, the Verve Clicquot story is an example of one incident when you were doing good for me, and it forged even a deeper level of friendship and a lifetime of support and friendship. So I thank you for that. So this is definitely a question for you, Fleur. I mean, You seem to be the eternal teenager, as far as I'm concerned, always bubbly and bright, and a testament to the fact that I'm very lucky in having a daughter that's probably as good a friend with my friends as she is with her own.
So true.
And yeah. So when you grow up, Fleur, what do you want to be?
You.
No, I feel very old now.
Oh, no, you're only a couple of years older than me. No, I think who I want to be is someone who's, going back to your podcast, how you want to be remembered, somebody that always made people feel welcome. And the way I do that is by welcoming people into my home and cooking for them and creating an environment where people feel safe and loved and appreciated. That's probably the person I want to be when I grow up. And hopefully I'm achieving that through, my kids are growing now, so they don't come around as often as I would like. But I do love yeah, entertaining and having people around. So.
So the hostess with the mostest, yeah. Obviously, is probably yeah. a great kind of yeah. typology for you.
Yeah, I do love it.
And I know that we will be seeing you. You often do get from me the job of managing the food tables. I'm sure that we'll be seeing you at this year's Labels on the Lawn, being
yes.
quite glamorous behind the beautiful food tables, or perhaps the gin or champagne bar, whatever's offering at the time.
Happily.
But you tend to be the hostess on most of those days, looking after people and their culinary and refreshing needs, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't know that you've spoken about Labels much on your first podcast, but it is like the event every year at Hanworth that I absolutely love. Not only do I walk away with some amazing, beautiful dresses and accessories and stuff, but it is, again, something where a lot of women come together over fashion and bubbles, but also benevolence, because it benefits Women's Legal Service, which
absolutely.
Is something that's very close to both of us.
Yes, and Fleur, I'm very fortunate in that she's one of my team of volunteers. It's a very great thing to volunteer with, because you get to see the mm-hmm. fashions at the coalface.
Yes.
Feeding the front line in terms of the labels and what's coming in, and the generosity of people in Brisbane and Queensland who give to Labels on the Lawn. And so I'm sad that this podcast is coming to an end.
It's,
podcast gives you such a wonderful opportunity to sit down with people, even people that you know, and learn something new about them. And so I'm so excited we've started this journey. But in closing, I think there's a beautiful question about what brings you happiness?
I really think that being with my family, as I'm older, becoming older, whenever I have an opportunity to come together, not just with my children and my beautiful husband and my stepson, but also my wider family. And it was a great example last year. My 96-year-old grandmother finally went in to live in a lovely place called Palm Lake in Toowoomba, but we had to pack up and sell the family home. And that was a really sad occasion for me, but I felt, because all of the family came together to sort of celebrate, have our final dinners together, pack up her stuff, divide it amongst us. And even though it was a very sad few days that we were letting go of this house that had been in my life my entire life, I've got the greatest sense of love and belonging, and we ate together. It sounds cliche, but it truly is. It's family. It's what makes me really happy.
So on that note, let's toast this beautiful glass of Veuve Clicquot, our champagne of the house and the champagne of our friendship, to many more years of bubbles, many more years of benevolence, and definitely many, many more years of being besties. Thanks for being on the show, Fleur.
It's my pleasure, Marisa. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to Bubbles and Benevolence today. We hope you enjoyed listening to Marisa's conversation with Fleur as much as we enjoyed recording it. We strive to bring you interesting and useful information with each episode, and we hope you learned something new today, like making sure you always check your guest's dietary requirements before cooking. If you're interested in trying out the souffle recipe that was discussed in today's episode, you can find a link to it in the episode description. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, please feel free to reach out to us at podcast@hanworthhouse.com.au. That's Hanworth, Hanworth. We always love hearing from our listeners. To stay up to date with future episodes, please be sure to subscribe. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we would be incredibly grateful if you could take a moment to leave us a review. Your feedback helps us improve our content and reach more people. As a thank you for listening to Bubbles and Benevolence, Fleur is excited to offer our listeners a 20% discount on her online cooking courses. These courses are a fantastic way to develop your cooking skills and learn new recipes from the comfort of your own home. To redeem your discount, go to the link in the episode description and simply use the code BUBBLES at checkout. This offer is only available for a limited time, so be sure to take advantage of it while you can. Thank you once again for joining us today. We'll be back soon with another special guest.
Cheers!
Cheers!